This is an ABC podcast.
Rhianna Patrick on ABC Radio.
Julie, what is the story that you wanted to tell in Benevolence?
I wanted to tell a story about the Hawkesbury River and Aboriginal history of the Hawkesbury River, but from an Aboriginal point of view. I get very sick as a writer of Indigenous descent to have to read about the history of Australia always from such a white colonial perspective. And it was the seeing the play The Secret River, which was adapted by Andrew Bavell from Kate Grenfell's book, The Secret River, left me very disturbed and unhappy and crying, really, because of the scenes at the end of the novel were of massacres of Darug people, which I knew to be completely untrue in the particular context that was described. And so I just decided I needed to write some kind of reply to that and to investigate what I knew about my family's history along the river and actually celebrate the resilience and celebrate the women that survived. And yeah, that's why I wrote it.
Julie, I feel like because of not only the writing but also your work that you do outside of writing novels, that the power of words means a lot to you. And I wanted to know about what is the power of words for you, because the title of the book is saying something for the reader before it has even started, even if they don't realise it.
Yeah. Well, it's an ironic word, benevolence. And I do refer to people like Governor Lachlan Macquarie, who felt they were being very benevolent towards Aboriginal people by, for example, starting the Parramatta Native Institution in Parramatta in 1816. But the reality of that, Governor Lachlan Macquarie was benevolent in some ways, and I do portray them in the novel as well. But the fact of the matter is he ordered the Appin Massacre in 1816, and his troopers went down to Appin to teach the natives, the Gunungurra people, who they referred to as the renegades and the mountain tribes, a lesson for constantly attempting to stop settlers from taking their land. And it resulted in a large massacre. We're not quite sure how many people were killed, but it could be up to 100 people were pushed off a cliff in Appin. And part of his orders to the punitive expedition was to bring back a bag of heads. So they brought back a bag of Aboriginal heads, which were sent to Joseph Banks at the Royal Academy in London for examination, and also to bring back some pretty children so his wife could start a school in Parramatta. And the benevolence of colonial authorities is tinged with the horror of massacre and oppression of Aboriginal people. So I wanted to investigate that title to try to portray, I hoped fairly, the way that colonial people, how they felt about being in Australia and what they did, and compare that to my protagonist, who's Murrugeen, who was given the name Mary Jane, who's based on my great-great Aboriginal grandma, three greats, at how she retaliates against this kind of treatment.
Julie, I'm going to ask you about your great-great-great-grandmother soon and that story that you wanted in this book, but I'm intrigued by you talking about, wanting to set the record straight, putting yourself as an Aboriginal woman into the role of what would these non-Indigenous settlers have been feeling. How did you go about putting yourself into an 1800s context as an Aboriginal woman in that story that is told in this book? How did you then flip that switch, I suppose, of then trying to concentrate on what was going through maybe a settler's or occupier's mindset at that time?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, and the fact is the answer to it really lies in kind of the way I was brought up and educated. I grew up in Sydney, in Boronia Park, which is a community, which is a big piece of national park and bush right on the Lane Cove River, in a housing commission house. Now, that area now is part of a very trendy area in Sydney called Hunter's Hills, right? But when I grew up, my dad used to take us fishing down on the river, and we put out pots for crabs, and we collected oysters off the river. And we had this kind of bush existence, and we were right in the middle of Sydney, right? And I was one of the first, myself and my brother were the first people in our family to go to university, for example. So while we grew up with a dad who was very Aboriginal in his ways, he never said the words, "I'm an Aboriginal man," and yet he looked just like Adam Goods, and he was a real bushy in so many ways. But going off to university, suddenly all the books you had to read at university if you're studying English, they were all, you know, they were Jane Austen or they were, you know, Fielding. And suddenly you've got this huge array of English literature. You know, there was no Australian literature when I went to university. And there were certainly very few women portrayed, I can tell you that, female writers. And so I had that was kind of my education. But as soon as I finished university, the first thing I did was go and live with an Aboriginal community up in Bourke. And then after that, I went off and lived in remote Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. That was the culture I longed to find out about because I'd grown up with so little knowledge.
But Julie, the start of this book has a map showing where Darug country is, but also the country of others. How historically correct is this map? Where did you find this map and why did you want that at the start of the book for the reader?
I asked Mugabala. Mugabala has been fantastic. I mean, they've sat with this novel with me for 5 years, Rachel Binsala, like blessings upon her because no one else wanted the book, that's for sure. So thank heavens for Aboriginal publishers. That's all I can say. When I asked for a map, they said, oh, well, what do you want in it? So I sent them a kind of a rough drawn map of what I want in it. And I said, look, I'd really like people to be able to trace Murugin's journey, you know, put their finger on where she started up in Currajong in the mountains and she ends up at the Parramatta Native Institution and then she ends up in Windsor with the Reverend and also she travels then back to Currajong with her Aboriginal lover with Boothery and places where she had the babies and I just thought, look, anyone who's reading this book, they can constantly refer to this at the beginning and we made sure, Mugabala and myself, that the Aboriginal nations and clans were also represented, the ones that were significant to this story. A lot have been left out because we can't be everything to all people, but we have used, you know, the names of different clans that are mentioned in the novel, and certainly the nations are definitely portrayed on this map. I love this map.
I enjoyed at least having an understanding of when I am out on other people's country, when I'm in Sydney, of knowing whose it is, because sometimes that information is not easy to come by.
No. No. And believe me, if you get 10 Aboriginal people in a room, 10 of them all have a different opinion about where those borders are.
Yeah, that's it.
The clan ownership of country. You open up a whole can of worms if you start trying to draw lines around it.
Well, Julie, for the reader, this book can probably feel a little bit hard going because you use Darug language in it. And I want to know, what was your purpose and the role that you wanted Darug language to play in this novel?
Yes. Well, initially I actually sent a word list to Rachel Binsala of all the Darug words I was using and she's kind of wrote back and said, no, this is exhausting. Just use the words in the context of the novel and hope that we're going to be able to understand them. So it was a bit of a struggle for me to be able to use Darug words and make sure that the reader who doesn't understand any Darug language would understand what the words mean. And I think I gradually kind of teach people the meaning of quite a few words through kind of clever, you know, techniques of putting a word next to an English word. Of course, I had to use some Darug language because when our character of Murugin is first introduced to the readers, she's a little girl on her father's shoulders coming down from the Currajong area into Parramatta to be given away to the Parramatta Native School. Now, the reason why her father would have done that, this is based on historical, not my family's historical fact, but the fact of other Aboriginal families' historical fact, is some of the parents of children felt that if their children could go to the school, the native school, and learn English, they could become a go-between between Aboriginal people and the colonists and perhaps sort out some of the major disagreements that were happening between people when land was being taken. So I had to have Murugin very quickly gain an understanding of English so that the readers could get into her head and understand her thoughts and feelings. So I made her quite a sophisticated young woman. I mean, even me as a little girl, my mum would take me up to the library every week. I'd come back with a great pile of books. I read every single play in the local library in Gladesville from A to Z when I was 13 and 14 years of age. I really liked literature. I loved books and I loved reading. I'm still a bookworm. And so the use of those Aboriginal words is terribly important to me for people to celebrate their meanings and become familiar with them and use them.
Julie, do you think that if you had had this book published by a non-Indigenous publisher that you would have had the license to use as many Aboriginal language words without sometimes context and just in the flow of the narrative that you're trying to construct? Do you think that would have happened the way that it did with Mugabala?
I think it would have actually, because there are some examples. I mean, Kim Scott's wonderful book, The Dead Man Dance, for example, has got a large number of Noongar words spread throughout the text, as has Terra Nullius and a couple of other works from Aboriginal people on the western side of Australia. And so I think this is already something that's already happening. Tara June Winch's beautiful book, Yield, is all about Wiradjuri language. That's a magnificent novel. It's not really a novel, rather than kind of a philosophical lesson in language. It's a beautiful, well-deserved winner.
One that I still have on my bookshelf, Julie. I still haven't got to it yet, so that's lovely to know that I'm about to, when I get into it, there's a surprise waiting for me.
It's
so thank you.
Beautiful.
Julie, the thing that struck me about this book as well, which is why I kind of wanted to do this interview in a different way than I would normally do when I talk to authors, is for me the fact that I was kind of having to not struggle with the both sides of myself, but I had to think about why it was that I needed to know something. And so as a Torres Strait Islander, for me, the age of the character was not necessarily important. And then the non-Indigenous side of me wanted to know the age of the character. And it was something that I really struggled with. And I had to think about that for a moment while reading this book and going on the journey of,
I see what you mean.
Yeah, of thinking of, if my old people were telling me a story, would they say such and such was at this age when they did this thing in part of the story? And they wouldn't. They'd say he was a young man, they were a young woman. They were a child, whatever it was. But for some reason, it made me question that, which is why I thought, I can ask you how old the protagonist is and how old they are when we meet them and how old they are when the story ends. But does that really matter?
look, I guess it doesn't. And I guess why I wasn't saying now, at 13, she ran away with Boothry, and at 16, she had the baby, because certainly in the traditional Aboriginal communities that I've lived in, nobody knows when they were born. I was born under that tree, back before they put the railway.
So true.
And it was, which I think is just wonderful. It's like, well, the old guys would say, oh, back before the war. which war? Right? And so I guess I did. To me, it wasn't terribly important. I had a few. I had some wonderful editors work with me. Margaret Wiskin from Mugabala being one of them, and she'd say, "Julie, you need to sit down and write a timeline to get it really clear in your head when everything's happening and how old she is." And I'd be like, "Oh, do I really have to? I'm not very good at math." So you picked up a bit of a flaw in the book in some ways, but it's just the way, it just felt much more natural for me to just assume when she ran away with Boothry that she was old enough. A lot of the girls, once they reached puberty, like 13 or 14, they took off with an Aboriginal boyfriend in the bush and were never seen again.
And I suppose I wonder, Julie, is that where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writing could be heading, that we're getting back to a basis of storytelling in a way where age doesn't matter. These finer details that are needed in writing, that when it comes to Indigenous storytelling, they're not necessarily the details that are needed to tell that story.
No,
so I wonder, with everything that you do, I mean, do you think that this is an exciting time where that possibility of getting to a place that is somewhere that's different for Indigenous storytelling, but is true to the way that we tell stories, could be something that we see in the future when it comes to novels?
Yes, I do. And I think that's already, a lot of work has been done in that direction. I mean, the wonderful Jack Davis in his plays that he wrote back in the 1980s, had an extraordinary kind of a real sense of being inside an Aboriginal family and an Aboriginal way of thinking. And he really paved the way for other writers afterwards to release that kind of different way of looking at the world. You don't have to look through the world through the gaze of Jane Austen, for God's sake, that there is another way of looking at the world. But, I've grown up between the two worlds. My three times great Aboriginal grandmother, she had children, and one of those children was to a white man, we're pretty sure was a reverend of the church. And then a great-great-grandma, Mary Thomas, had four children that were given away to the Benevolent Society. So the records say, given, because she couldn't feed the children. Well, there's a lot of mysteries into that little bit of writing on the Benevolent Society form which says given, you know, really, were they given, were they taken, was she forced to give them up, was she starving, you know, what happened? And then she went on and she married a white man. So you've got this thing of four generations of Aboriginal women in my family all marrying men of non-Indigenous background. So it creates that dilemma of you want to tell both stories, try to have some understanding of both sides of yourself. And I find it is a challenge. You know, I'm not living in a remote community in Arnhem Land with traditional people. You know, I've grown up in a city and with, you know, surrounded by white people. And so it's a different, it's hard to travel the path through both worlds. But I think at this particular moment with everyone talking about Black deaths in custody, but my next novel is about a Black death in custody, by the way. It's called Wilga. It is a time for people to kind of stand up and say, look, we're really sick of having this colonial, white, European way of looking at the world shoved down our throat every single day. And just to thank heaven for the media having some Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander presenters. It's a relief to be able to hear them and to find another way of telling stories. And how about the stories of the early Chinese in the community or the stories of the Matassan traders who went to the Torres Strait and to the Northeast Arnhem Land and to the Kimberley? I mean, I'm just interested in other stories other than the colonial white story all the time, the European English story.
Well, Julie, to ask you a really non-Indigenous framed question, what is that conversation that you wanted to have? I mean, you mentioned, the colonial context there, but what was that conversation in benevolence that you wanted to have around the colonial experiment?
Well, I just think that for so long, the whole story in the history of Australia has been whitewashed. You know, grew up hearing about Blacks from Wentworth and Lawson crossing the Blue Mountains and MacArthur growing merino sheep and sort of with this total lack of Aboriginal perspective in the stories and all the statues around the place of Governor Lachlan Macquarie or Cook. Well, you know, I agree with not so much pulling them down and destroying them, but Julia Baird suggested taking them off their pedestals and putting them down and setting them in the ground in concrete and putting statues of all the people they'd oppressed all around them. And I thought, wow, now you're talking. Now that's a monument I'd like to look at, you know. The people who are blackbirded and Aboriginal people who were forced to work on estates, as my family was for several generations. They were servants on estates or log splitters on estates and have them surrounded by the people who were around them and they benefited from the English people got rich basically from the blood, sweat and tears of the Aboriginal people they oppressed and took their land. So let's put them all on the same pedestal together and have a discussion.
And I feel like this book is kind of, in a way, maybe a written form of what you've just said, because you really do challenge the reader to get their heads around an Aboriginal language. You challenge the reader to not think about what age the protagonist is, you know, what age Murrunging is, so I wonder also, I know that you do poetry and I was interested to know how you went around interweaving your own poetry into this novel.
Well, look, I'll give you a really honest answer and it'll be hard to hear, but I was so frustrated and saddened by the fact that I couldn't get any of the... I published a novel myself called The Crocodile Hotel about my time in the Northern Territory some years ago.
Which is 2015, yes?
That's right, The Crocodile Hotel. And then this book, I could not get a publisher for it. It was rejected by every mainstream publisher. And I was so sad that I just decided, look, I'm going to take some of the material that I've worked so hard on in this novel and I'm going to compress them into poems, you know. And so that's what I did. And then, lo and behold, I've won two major awards, the Yujiru Noonuckle with the Shared Award and then the Judith Rice. And no one could have been more surprised than me because I hadn't written a poem since I was 17 when my dad died. I wrote my last poem and Dad died in a car accident. And I felt that was it. I was putting a line under poetry forever. Once he'd gone, the poetry had gone out of me. I was so sad. I write occasional poems, but they're not my main form, I must admit. I like the struggle of the novel. I like to be crying with frustration for 5 years over a novel. So when the rewards come, my heavens above, I think you deserve them.
Julie, with this being such a personal story in a way, how aware were you of talking you know, of those things that you talk about in this, I mean, how much did you protect yourself as well? Because, I mean, this kind of story brings up a lot of trauma. And I think regardless of whether you understand the trauma that's playing out, to sometimes read some of those historical texts of what went on and the way that people were treated, that can take a toll on you even as a writer, even if you've got just that kind of veil between it. And with that being a personal story, I wondered how you protected yourself from not only putting your heart and soul into the novel, but also protecting your heart.
Yeah. Well, I've been asked that question before, and I always find it's a bit of a puzzling one. I think by the very act of writing, and I encourage any person, whether Indigenous or not, to have a go at writing or at painting, or, you know, the creative arts can really help you with things that you're suffering. By actually writing these kind of stories, it helps me to, I guess, heal myself or to heal my own family. I mean, the story of Murugyng having a child out of wedlock, that was me in 1971. I had a baby at university. As my son now refers to himself, is, I'm my mother's university love child.
Oh, no.
and I was deserted as soon as I was pregnant. So, and so I had to bring him up myself while trying to finish, and I finished university. But basically, we lived on Weet-Bix, you know, and I would carry him to uni on my back, and by the time I paid the preschool fees, I had no money for food, so we just lived on Weet-Bix. But so I mean, I can laugh about it now, but I guess if I hadn't felt some of those extreme situations, and I lived in Bourke for a year, and I was a single mother in Bourke, and the local Aboriginal girls and the Yempa girls and the Gamilaroi girls would all stand up outside the police station with a baby on their hip to collect some money to help them survive, because the single girls, the ones who had babies and didn't have a man to help them, and we'd all line up together out there in the sun in Bourke. It's bloody hot, you know, 42 degrees or something, and you'd finally get to the door of the police station. You'd go in, there'd be this big police officer sitting up there on this really high, you know, desk, and he'd lean down and he'd say, "Are you sleeping with anyone?" And of course, you'd always go, "Oh no, no, of course not. It's me, if you were." And he'd give you your ticket, which was fire, famine and flood relief. At least it was alliteration. I mean, think about it. And that was like your basic card. And so you'd go down to the local supermarket and you'd take that in. But everyone would know you had this, you know, it's like having the basics card. You know, you'd go in with this card and someone would, a lady at the checkout would yell out, "You can't have those tampons on that card. You can only have food. You have to take them back," with everyone staring at you, you know. Now, look, I'm not in that situation now. I've become, you know, as a grandma now in my life and working as a university lecturer, you know, thanks very much, I'm quite comfortable. But I do remember those, and I think having had some of those experiences in my life and being rejected back in the 1970s, it's not like today. It's all very fashionable to have a child and not be married. Nobody gives a damn, especially in Aboriginal communities. Aboriginal communities never gave a damn. A baby's a baby. You love them no matter where they came from, you know. But, you know, there was a lot of degree of kind of prejudice against people like me. And I always just put my chin forward and put my chest out, and I just thought, well, this is me and I'm going to survive and I'm going to bring up this child, and you know, you can all just wear it, you know. And I'd always had that strength and resilience. So I drew on that to create Murugyng.
Yeah, and I think there's a part, you know, there's a lot in the book, particularly describing Murugyng, where you talk about, you know, she puts on a brave, strong front all the time, and doesn't want to buckle, and, you know, won't cower to what's going on as well. And that obviously has come through from your own experiences. And I suppose I also wondered about, you know, having food insecurity in your life at one point, about that feeding in, really bad pun, about that information and you know, that experience being put into your novel of, you know, you have descriptions about not only Aboriginal people being very hungry, you know, and starving in this book, but also the convicts, the non-Indigenous convicts that Murugyng sees as she's part of this native institution school, who are sort of, you know, not being fed properly and constantly asking the young ones to grab them food and things like that. So I felt like, now that you've explained that to me, those descriptions that are in the book make a lot of sense, you know, in the way that you've written them.
Yeah, I wanted her to have compassion because it's one thing I got from my mum, who's of English heritage. Well, my mum has a great sense of compassion. So did my dad, but my dad was mostly mending birds' wings and things like that, mostly after he'd shot them. But anyway, but, you know, dad was compassionate as well. But mum has this deep compassion. She's still alive, my mum, God bless her. And the idea that this little girl would see this starving man outside the window and would just automatically, you know, get him some bread, it just seems to me just so normal. That's what you do. If you see suffering, then you must do something about it. And I wanted that to come through in her character, that she wasn't just a, you know, a tough look after myself kind of person, but that she does care for others. I think it's important that I show that about her. Yeah, but I did enjoy, there are some parts in the novel which I've been sometimes criticised for, which, you know, it's kind of sexy bits, and also the bits where there's a lot of dialogue, because my background is a playwright. I wrote the play Black Mary, which was on at Belfast Street Theatre before the seats fell down, and I have a scene in the novel where Murrigan has to speak up to a jealous wife. And it's a fiery scene of two women and a man having this kind of fiery argument about sexual jealousy. Well, I think many, many people and many, many readers in their life have experienced that kind of jealousy. And so I actually really enjoy writing those kind of scenes because they, you know, they really liven a book up.
Well, I mean, Julie, I suppose, you know, to ask the non-Indigenous question yet again, what do you hope readers get out of this book? I mean, what do you want them to take with them apart from learning a bit of Dharug language along the way?
Well, I'd like them to see that Australia's history is made up of a lot of extraordinary women who just get completely ignored, and Aboriginal women especially get ignored. And I just think that it's time to turn around and appreciate. Look, every Aboriginal woman or sister or cousin that I've ever worked with or known, I know so many incredibly resilient, strong, passionate, wonderful women I've met in my life. And that's why I always put a woman at the centre of my novels, even though the men try to take over, but I knock them back, right? But I want to write books that celebrate those women. And my new novel called Wilga is about an Aboriginal woman who's closer to my own age. She's Auntie June, and she's in her late 50s. And Auntie June is really resilient, and she's fighting to save the Darling River when the Darling River is dried up through all the cotton farmers extracting too much water. And but it's also a novel about Black death in custody. So it's very timely. And that's the novel I'm now looking for a publisher for.
You're listening to Rhianna Patrick on ABC Radio.